Welcome to Prepping for the Studio. If you're a musician or musical artist that wants to learn more about what goes on, how to prepare, or how to make the most out of your studio session, you're in the right place. Prepping for the Studio. Episode 7. Roy and Brian continue their discussion on what goes on in a tracking session. How might you go about making takes? How do you overcome recording anxiety? They also talk about the importance of performance and putting emotion into what you do. Steps in the process like comping, editing, tuning, overdubbing, and rough mixes are also discussed. Thanks for joining. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Prepping for the Studio, the podcast for musicians who want to know more about the studio, how to prepare, how to make the most of their time and money, and what to expect. I'm Roy Silverstein, and I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Schubel.
Hello.
What's up, Brian?
Not much.
Cool. Well, we're here at episode 7, believe it or not. And we've gone through a whole bunch of stuff, and we're actually at a point where it's time to hit record.
Yeah.
Finally.
Right on.
I feel like everyone's probably been waiting. When are they actually going to get to the recording part?
That was all the setup. So yeah. It's like setting the mics up and...
We were doing all kinds of preparation stuff and pre-production and getting your instruments ready and et cetera, et cetera. And now finally, we are ready to hit record.
Yeah.
So there's different ways to go about making takes. Let's call it making takes. You can do the song from start to finish. That's one option. So basically that lets you have all these, you know, takes. And you can do what's called comping, if you want, of those takes, which is like kind of maybe using the chorus from this one, the verse from that one, blah, blah, blah. And it's a pretty easy way to go about it, but you got to play the whole song through. Another thing you can do is you can record up until a point where you make a mistake, if you do make a mistake, and then you can punch in, right? Punching in is when you'll hear like everything a little bit before the mistake, and then it starts recording and you start playing and replace the audio hopefully with good audio. Or you can try doing things in sections. So in that case, you can just focus on recording the chorus and or just record the first one and just do it over and over until you get one that you actually like. Or you can do some combination of all these things.
Yeah.
You know? Do some full takes and then be like, okay, now let's focus in on the chorus. And then, you know, be like, oh, well, everything's great except I need to punch in this line.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, right?
Yep.
So let's talk about some of the like pros and cons, I guess, of the different ways of doing it. Full takes, I mean, that lets you get like into the full song, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Get the vibe.
Yeah. You get the full vibe. You get the full performance of you doing the song, and that can be good for you know, really expressing yourself throughout the song and the dynamics of it. And
yeah, totally.
But you have to do the full song, which, you know, takes a while, maybe gets old, I don't know. Punching in is really convenient, but it can be tricky because in the pre-roll section, the time when you're hearing like what you did prior to it, depending on how it's set up, you may not be able to hear your live mic, and that can cause you to like play too loud sometimes, or just not kind of like match the tonality or whatever.
Yeah.
And then when you actually are in record, like it might sound weird and it can be obvious that it's a punch in.
Mm-hmm. Louder or different vibe.
Right.
Softer.
So it can be tricky. It takes a little practice, but totally doable.
Mm-hmm.
And then recording in sections, I mean, that's cool because it lets you focus in on a particular section. The downside is you maybe don't have that flow that you would get doing take to take, and maybe it will sound a little disjointed.
Yeah, but if there's like a lick you're really trying to get or something, you can really do it over and over and over and over until you really
get solos.
Get a few you like, and then...
Solos are often done, I think, like, let's just do the solo a million times.
Totally. Yep.
And then you can comp that.
And you can punch on that too.
Yes, of course. That's the thing, is you can do combination of all these things. Whatever method you choose, like here's how it kind of goes down. Like the engineer is going to talk to you over the headphones. Okay. That's what we call that talk back, right? And they're going to tell you something like, okay, we're rolling, which probably referred to tape machines, which actually had reels that rolled,
I guess. Yep.
Nowadays, if you're recording digital, there's nothing rolling. But
even though they may say, we're recording. Yeah,
we're recording. We're
rolling.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Or they'll give you some cue, or you might hear a click track come in. If you are working with a click track, like, and this is like you're recording the, you know, from the top of the song, leave some clicks in there, like eight clicks or something like that.
Count off is nice.
Yeah, a little count off. Maybe the drummer does a little, you know, four clicks too if they're recording with the drummer. But it's good to make that consistent. And if you're trying to do multiple takes from top to bottom that you're going to comp, you want to definitely like start always at the same spot.
Yeah, that's very helpful, especially if you're doing playlists in Pro Tools.
Yes, exactly. Playlist is like basically you have all the different takes that you did in kind of like a drop down menu in Pro Tools and other programs too. But in Pro Tools, it's really easy to like then like audition, you know, each take and make that comp, that compilation of takes.
Yeah. There's one thing I wanted to just go over. Probably should have spoke sooner. Is when you say tracking. In the old days, tracking was always when the whole band is together playing. Mm-hmm. And so you have drums, bass, guitar, whatever it is.
Right.
And tracking can also, because I was talking to you earlier before we actually started recording, tracking can also be, let's say the guitar player is going to redo his guitar track. So that he's tracking his guitar track.
Right.
And the one thing I was going to say about if you're tracking and everybody's decided to play all the way through, my feeling is you always let, even if somebody makes mistakes, you keep going because the drummer might be killing it.
Yeah.
He just might be like, I'm on fire. And all of a sudden you stop the take. He's going to be not too happy about
it. Especially if you're really isolated, because if you're isolated, then people can replace their mistakes without interfering with the other.
Totally. You can come back and do an overdub.
It's more tricky when there is a lot of bleed.
Yeah.
Then that may not work.
Yeah.
But it depends on how much bleed.
But that's something you talk about and when, you know, before you start, you know, if you're all tracking together. I mean, you certainly can stop and punch in, but, you know, just something to remember.
Right. Yeah, good point. Good point. But if you are doing the full takes thing, you probably are going to want to record to a click. So that just makes the timing consistent throughout, you know. If you don't do it with a click, then, like, it can be hard to comp different takes together because maybe you played this chorus faster than the other. And then like, it's just hard to, you know, use this part because it's actually now off from the other. And so better if you do recording to a click, if you're going to use that method.
Yeah. I've seen guys where you just use the click to count off, hoping that they'll hold on to that tempo, but it's still
depends
not.
How good your drummer is.
Yeah.
And other people in the band.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically, yeah, the engineer is going to give you a cue that you should start. You start. If you make a mistake, that's, I think, what your point was. Maybe don't stop. Depends, you know. But if the whole band is like completely messed up, then you just stop and you just either go back to the top or you punch in or, you know, do whatever. And sometimes it can take a lot of takes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, don't feel bad about it.
And false starts.
Yeah. I mean, engineers get used to this.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we're going to. We know, like, some bands, like, are really tight, and it only takes them one take or three takes, you know, and it's done. And other groups, it's like, no, it's going to be a lot of takes.
Yeah, and you may even want to come back to it.
Yeah, yeah. You may have to take a break, come back. Because, yeah, what can happen is what I call red light syndrome, which is everything is cool until you know you're recording, and then suddenly you're really nervous and you're really anxious. And it happens to the best of us. I mean, I've experienced it as, because I used to, you know, be a musician. Well, I guess I'm sort of still a musician.
It never goes away.
Yeah, but I've recorded myself even, you know, and even doing that, I would get nervous when I knew I was recording.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's a lot of things in your head, you know, a lot of feelings, of expectations maybe of yourself, of maybe you feel like your bandmates maybe have expectations, or maybe you think the engineer, the producer has certain expectations. And
yeah.
And if you're in a studio situation and you know that the clock is ticking and you're paying by the hour, you know, that might be bothering you, or a lot of things could be bothering you. And just, it's not your bedroom anymore. It's, you know. I mean, that's the importance of, I think last time we talked about kind of making your space feel comfortable, because it helps a lot to feel comfy,
but totally.
it happens. And if you can remember that you're just recording music.
Yeah.
You're not doing surgery.
Yeah.
No one's going to die here.
Yeah. And sometimes getting through that first take can help you relax, you know.
Yeah.
First couple takes maybe.
Right.
Because you realize nothing's going to happen. You're playing the song.
Yeah. You're just playing music here. It's supposed to be fun, you know. And if you're doing it right, it is fun. But maybe you also have some relaxation strategies, some breathing work, or things that you might do otherwise for your life. You can use those things, you know. And yeah, that might help you, you know. Or you can take a break. Mm-hmm. It can take a while, you know. But the thing that's cool is that sometimes those first takes are still the best takes, even if you were kind of nervous. Mm-hmm. Because your energy was fresh, and there's can often sometimes be something magical in those takes. So,
yeah, totally.
You know, just get through them. And you never know, some of those might actually make the cut.
Yeah. And remember, between takes, check your tuning.
Oh, yes.
Nothing worse than getting through a song and you realize you're out of tune.
Right. I think we've mentioned it before, but it just serves to mention again. Tune, just tune.
Yeah.
Between every take.
Yep.
Why not?
Yeah.
So totally normal to have this red light syndrome. You can get through it. You can get past it. And the more recording you do in a studio, I think the more you'll get used to the studio situation.
Yep. True.
I want to emphasize also the need to impart, you know, emotion into your performance. Mm-hmm. Because timing and tuning, these things can be fixed. And we'll talk about that. But it's impossible for an engineer to imbue the recording with emotion. Mm-hmm. If it's not there, it's just not there.
Yeah.
So I would err on the side of really going for it with your performance and worrying less about hitting the note exactly or hitting the timing exactly and focus more on playing with feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree with that.
Yeah, because it's just impossible to put it in there if it's not there.
Yeah, there's no emotion plug-in yet.
Hasn't been invented yet. We'll see. Maybe someone will come up with some way of doing that. But right now, it's up to the human being to, you know, actually impart that stuff. So, yeah, I would say the song's number one, but the performance is number two. So if you can put in that energy into the performance, it's really going to outshine any deficiencies elsewhere in the whole thing. And if you think about older recordings, I mean, they're full of things that are out of tune because they didn't have pitch correction. Mm-hmm. They're full of even like recording errors, let's call them, like
distortion,
unintentional distortion because the singer got really loud and like overdrove the mic pre. Doesn't matter though, right? Like these old recordings, the classic recordings, everyone still loves them.
Yeah. Trying to copy them too.
Yeah. and why? Because I think the performances were so great. Mm-hmm. And the songs were great too, but the performances too, you know, was a big part of it.
Yep. Yeah.
So there's definitely something to be said there about, you know, how it can really outshine even a mistake or you know, technical error, anything.
Yeah. One thing I could say is that sometimes when you're doing it by yourself, let's say you're doing a vocal, it's time to do vocals without the band.
Okay.
Is you can oversing. Like somebody's saying to you, you got to put emotion into it and you got to do, you know, this and that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can have singers overdo it almost to a point where it's kind of, it's not real.
Right.
You know, it's you got to feel it inside and pull that out rather than try to push it out. So to speak.
Makes sense. I think it helps to actually try to go to the place of what the song is about to you. If you wrote the lyrics, let's say, as the singer, you know, which often is the case, you know, try to remind yourself of what the song is about. Maybe have a photo or something that would remind you in front of you, that kind of thing.
It's a great idea. Yeah, totally.
But yeah, it needs to be genuine. Mm-hmm. I think people can often tell when you're phoning it in.
Yeah, disconnected from the song.
Yeah, or you're hamming it up or something like that. Yeah, over singing. Interesting. Yeah. It makes me think of something else, but now I can't remember what.
There's many times I've talked, I've said that to singers. They just got to relax.
Oh,
gotta get inside the song.
I know what it was. I've heard people talk about it should feel conversational.
Yeah.
You know, like you're singing to one person, because music does connect kind of to one person oftentimes. People are often listening to it by themselves on headphones or just in a room or whatever. It's only at a concert, really, when you especially get this like singing to a mass audience all at the same time. But music is very like one-to-one. So if you can just think about it like you're singing to one person, you're trying to connect with one person, I think that can help too.
I think that's when you hear artists or you've been to a show and it was just an amazing performance. It's because they connected. They felt it and they emoted it. It came out.
You know? Right. Yeah. And sometimes they make eye contact with individuals, like, and then they'll switch to someone else. And it may help, of course, if you're not looking at someone. I mean, we think we talked about that in the other episode. You might want to sing facing away from the glass where people are watching you, because it can feel like you're in a fishbowl and everyone's eyes are on you. And sometimes you might want to be kind of hidden away in a booth or like behind a gobo or something.
Yeah.
So that's all fine. You know, whatever can make you feel comfortable and give that performance. I think it's
a good headphone mix.
We talked about that too. Yeah. It just raise your hand. If your headphone mix sucks, like correct that, you know, make it so that you can feel really, really in the mix and part of the song.
Yeah.
I wanted to move on to what I called sorting through the mess. This is, you know, if you did do a bunch of takes, you know, and now you've got all this stuff in Pro Tools or wherever, that comping process or that picking of takes process, you know, is definitely a step along the way here, right? So if you're just listening to full takes and you're just gonna like, that's the take, you know, that can happen. But it could be like, well, the verse of this take is really good and the, you know, chorus of this take is good, then you do the comp. And you can have your engineer do that by themselves or producer do that by themselves, and then you can just kind of weigh in, or you could be very involved in that if you want. I kind of like it when people are involved, because then I can just, you know, let's say we have three takes, I can be like, okay, here's, I'll do it in little chunks, you know, like, let's say it's a vocal. I'll do like line by line, like, here's this line, take one, take two, take three. And then usually we all agree, like one of them is best.
Yeah.
You kind of just want to go through that and have some say in that, you know? So you want to, you know, get this right before you move on to another song or to like another step in the process, like let's say the overdub process, where maybe you're going to break down your setup. Let's say, you know, we're talking about doing your initial tracks, right? You know, you kind of want to know that you have it.
Yeah.
So this is a way that you can know for sure, is actually going through the process of going through the takes one by one and figuring out one is just perfect, or if you need to do a comp and you did the comp and okay.
Yeah, right.
Because once you start breaking down setups, it's hard to go back.
Yeah. And get the same sound.
Yeah, to get the exact same sound. Even with good notes, I mean, a microphone that's an inch off still can sound very different sometimes, depending on what you know, instrument's being mic'd. Best thing is to definitely know that you have it before you move on to the next start of the process.
Yeah.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Rarefied Recording.
Oh, that's me. I would be remiss if I didn't mention my studio, Rarefied Recording, and the services I offer there. The studio itself was built from the ground up, from the masterful plans of Mr. Wes Lachaud, so it sounds fantastic both in the control room and the live room. A 32-channel Neve Genesis console holds center court and is complemented by a wide array of outboard gear, instruments, and microphones. Your music will be in good company. If you live in the San Diego area, just head on over to rarefiedrecording.com to learn more and book a tour. You can also hear examples of my tracking and mixing work. If you aren't lucky enough to live in San Diego, let me be the first to suggest the idea of a destination recording experience. San Diego is BBB approved.
The Better Business Bureau?
No, beaches, burritos, and beer. Even if you're not a beach person, who's to complain with temperatures that are very often in the 70s? Even the winter months are averaging in the mid-60s. And being relatively dry, rain is unlikely to get in your way. The studio is very centrally located, and you can get to just about anywhere in the area in 15 to 20 minutes. Even Mexico. And while burritos are technically not a food you find in Mexico itself, San Diego has taken the concept to blissful culinary heights. You can't go hardly 100 yards here without running into a little taco shop that will be 10 times better than whatever options you have in your town. If Mexican isn't your thing, no worries. There are tons of great restaurants in the area, including a barbecue place 3 blocks away that rivals anything I've tried in Texas. And adjacent to it is one of over 150 craft breweries in San Diego. If you love beer, we gotcha. The West Coast IPA style is a specialty here, but we've got brewers doing all kinds of beers, and several have tasting rooms in walking distance. Did I mention that accommodations are available? So head on over to rarefiedrecording.com and reach out for a quote today. That's rarefiedrecording.com.
And now back to the episode.
Now, there is a step that we'll call editing and tuning that can happen after this, if it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And depending on what kind of music you're doing, like some music, I feel like you should probably shouldn't mess with it too much.
Yeah, right.
You know?
It's got a vibe.
Yeah, it's got a vibe. Like, yeah, there's little timing things that are like not perfect, quote unquote. Tuning maybe is like, yeah, slips here and there. But like I said, with the classic recordings, listen to them.
It's got a good vibe.
Yeah, like all that stuff's littered with.
Yeah.
Problems, quote unquote, of like that. So maybe your music is like that, where it's supposed to be a little bit loose. It's supposed to be very organic, and it doesn't need to be editor tuned. But some music really does, and only you can really make that call. I feel like it's a good idea if you can to do this step after the initial tracking before the overdubbing, so that whatever you overdub is kind of like connected now to the edit,
the master take.
Yeah, because you might change some major things. I mean, you can do what I call macro edits, right? You can be like, you know, this song's a little bit long. Like, why don't we chop off the last chorus or something?
Right, right.
Or, man, it really could use like the chorus to be doubled at the end, you know? So yeah, you can do like macro edits where you copy and paste things.
Yeah.
So better to do that kind of stuff ahead of time. But also, you know, even what I'd call micro edit, which would be like pushing a kick drum like a little bit left or right, you know, also better if you do that before you do overdubs, because then you're playing to that instead of playing to something that's actually going to be edited later. And then everything has to maybe be
shifted. Timing changes. Yeah.
Yeah. So a good idea if you can do that before you get into the overdub phase.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
At the very least, you want to do it before mixing.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a mixer, Brian, I mean, do you enjoy spending time editing and tuning when you should be actually mixing?
I don't, but I almost always have to.
You feel like you end up doing that, but it's not really mixing, right? It's editing.
It's editing. Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that, like you said, depending on the style of music, if it's something that's really tight and it needs to be really in time.
Yeah.
If that's really in time, the mix is going to sound better. But if it's got these downbeats that are kind of washy, you know, like everybody's hitting the downbeat a little off.
Right.
That's not going to be as punchy. So in order for me to get a really punchy mix, sometimes I have to go in and check those downbeats or, you know, even little things like that.
Right.
Or the tuning of the vocal is suspect. I might have to get a couple of notes here or there.
Yeah. Now, a couple things here and there is, I think, okay. But if you were given like a track that's like, whoa, this whole thing is way out of tune and it needs all kinds of editing, like you'd be spending significant amounts of time doing that, which isn't really mixing.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't want to do that to your mixer, because you want your mixer to spend their time actually doing mixing, which we'll talk about on another episode of this podcast, what mixing is all about. But
well, you know, there used to be what was called a Pro Tools guy back when we would record. And he was the guy, when you finished all your recordings, you sent it to him.
Right, right.
And he would edit it all.
Yeah.
He would go through all the tracks, edit and tune everything. And then you get it back and then you mix it.
And so that was a lot of power to that guy.
The big, Lars was the guy we used up in Portland. Yeah. Oh,
Lars.
Yeah. He's on a lot of big records.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, nowadays, I don't know if there's budget to have like a special guy, you know, or gal to do that, but there could be.
I mean, I find I'm doing it now.
Yeah.
You know, which is fine. You know, you just have to put on that hat and, you know, think about that only and not think about the other things.
Right. Yeah. It's very different than the more creative side of mixing. Yeah. I definitely prefer to have the editing and tuning happen before the mix. Now, speaking of tuning, it's mostly applied to vocals, but it actually can be done to other instruments if needed. People often associate it with auto-tune, but that's just one tool that's out there, right? And auto-tune can be used in a very aggressive way that has a particular sound that you've heard on a lot of records, modern records, that where you can hear this very like discrete steps between notes being hit.
Yeah.
It's used as an effect, really. Yeah. Oftentimes, the T-Pain thing or whatever, you know, it's become very, very common. People are using it as an effect, basically. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be that way. It can be done more subtly, and there's other tools that can be used, like Melodyne is one of them that can be very natural. Mm-hmm. And there's no real harm. You know, some people might think it's cheating or something like that. I mean, I think it's okay. Like, mm-hmm. if the performance was amazing, but there was just like a couple spots mm-hmm. where you just wear a little more out than you wanted to, like, hey, no harm.
Yeah.
Like, do a little tuning.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's okay.
Yeah. If it's bothering you, you know? So yeah, it auto-tunes, you know, people have a really negative thought about it sometimes, depends on
yeah.
what kind of music, but it doesn't have to be auto-tuned. It can be very precisely like, you know, this note needs to be adjusted. Everything else is fine.
Yeah. A syllable.
Yeah. Just one syllable. Yeah. So it can get real granular, right? Like that. I can't say that word.
Yeah. Seems to be more acceptable now, at least I think. When I get a song to mix, they say, well, can you tune it? Mm-hmm. It's, whereas before it was almost like, you don't talk about tuning, you know, because the singer may not want people to think they've ego, been tuned.
Yeah, maybe the ego feels a little bruised if they have to be tuned.
But now, I feel in the last couple of years, it's been, oh, yeah, yeah, do a little tuning if you need to, or, you know, it's a little more acceptance of it.
Yeah, I've felt like most people that I've worked with are totally cool with tuning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, I don't think it should be used to the nth degree unless it needs to be for the genre.
Right.
I try to keep it really natural when it makes sense, just, mm-hmm. you know, so you can't even tell, you know.
Yeah, me too.
Sometimes you could be more heavy-handed with like a background vocal, especially mm-hmm. if it's like a stack of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you want to usually, unless the genre calls for that real obvious tuning, it's usually you want to make sure it's done in a way that's not so obvious.
Yeah.
And the tools now are good enough to do that. So
yeah.
So we mentioned about overdubbing, but let's talk about it a little more. You know, that's, well, after the initial tracking and probably this editing and tuning phase, you can add more tracks to the song, you can add more parts to the song, and you'll be hearing what you've done previously in the headphones and then playing on top of it. Mm-hmm. And you can approach that tracking of the overdubs just like you did the initial tracking, you know, full takes or punching in after you make a mistake or just work on sections or mm-hmm. combination.
Yeah.
And you might have the red light syndrome thing happen.
Especially if everybody's staring at you.
Yeah.
At least when the band's all playing, they're doing their own thing. And you right. only have a couple eyes maybe looking at you from the control room. Whereas mm-hmm. when it's you doing the vocal, you have the whole band looking at you and
yeah.
the engineers looking at you.
Yeah, it can be a little more pressure, definitely, when it's an overdub. But try to use the relaxation techniques or whatever you need to do to like get yourself over that. Because yeah, all that stuff applies again in the overdub phase.
Yeah.
But that's where you can really like layer the song, you know, and
focus on your part.
Yeah. Or maybe you're replacing some parts from the initial tracking. Like let's say you did do guitars, mm-hmm. You know, with bass and drums, but maybe they just, you didn't think they were good enough.
Yeah.
Or they were recorded in a little ISO booth and you wanted more of like the sound of a fuller room. Then mm-hmm. you can move the guitar amp into a bigger room and you can do it again.
Yeah.
Or you can just play it better, experiment more, take some more time with it, mm-hmm. you know, try out some other amps.
Yeah.
You can go a little deeper.
Yeah.
And replace some stuff.
Yeah.
You know, or you're adding new parts.
Yeah. And come into the control room.
Yeah, well, that's the cool thing is when you're doing like guitars, you can be in the control room usually mm-hmm. and run lines to the wherever the amp is.
Yeah, and hear from the speakers rather than headphones, which is
yeah
nice.
Yeah, sounds a lot more natural to be on.
Yeah,
to be on speakers,
and your communication with the engineer too is a little easier because mm-hmm. there's no talk back or
yeah, yeah. It's way better to be in the same room as the engineer and the producer if there is one. So yeah, that's overdubbing. I mean, you do as many overdubs until you have the song at that point.
Unless you're on tape.
Right. Yes. We were just talking about earlier about tape. Tape has limits in terms of track count. So there you have to be a little more judicious with how many things you have going on. But Yeah, and usually in the digital world, it's basically unlimited tracks. Not that you need to do on crazy high track count stuff, just do what's appropriate for the song. But now along the way, at any point that you're stopping for the day or whatever, you might want to get some rough mixes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to give you a sense of like how things are going. Mm-hmm. Take them home, listen to them in your car or whatever. I mean, they are rough mixes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to remember that. Like, don't judge them too harshly as far as how they sound. Hopefully they're sounding cool, you know?
Yeah.
But don't come to your engineer and be like, man, this just doesn't sound as good as like this other thing that's released and already been like fully mixed. And
yeah.
That's not fair.
Yeah. Or something was too loud or.
Yeah. You know, get nitpicky. Oh, the reference is great, but you know, at such and such time, this guitar is too loud. It's like, yeah, okay, I know.
Yeah. The reverb's too much. Or,
yeah. Or, like, okay, noted. But it's just a rough mix. The point is to see if you maybe want to add more things to it, if the performances are good enough. That kind of thing, you know, you get a sense of that. It's definitely worth doing it. Now, rough mixes can take some time to create sometimes. Like, it's kind of annoying with, as an engineer, when, like, you get to the end of the session, like, you've used up all the time that they booked, and then they're like, hey, can we get a rough mix?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Because you're, at that point, the engineer is basically doing it on their own time, not getting paid for it.
Right, right.
So it's nice to leave some time at the end of the session, you know, however long the engineer thinks they need to do those rough mixes and let them do that.
Yeah. And he wants to do kind of a decent rough mix for you. I don't think anybody wants to just give you a bored balance.
Yeah.
You know, they want to maybe do a little bit of something to it.
Yeah. It's nice when you have a little time and then, yeah, it will sound that much better and it will give you a better sense of how the whole thing's coming together.
Yeah.
Now, you have to be careful also of what we'll call demo-itis, because you may have made a demo of the song, right? So now this is the first time you've heard a different recording of the song.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can be like, oh man, I like the demo more.
Yeah.
It might be because you've just listened to that demo a billion times. And that's now what you think of the song as.
Yeah. You're attached to it.
Yeah, attached to it in a weird way. So try to judge what this new recording sounds like on its own merits. You know, not overly thinking back to the demo.
And my guess is before you did the original demo, in your head, what you just did in the studio is what you always wanted to do, but you had to do the demo yourself because that's all you had.
Yeah.
So remember that. So yeah, judge it on its own merits, you know.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there may be something about the demo that you like better and you can try to work towards that, you know, it's fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a trap that you can fall into.
There's also, you know, if they were working in Pro Tools or Logic or something and they have something they just can't get better,
yeah,
you can sometimes pull that into the new version.
Totally.
If the tempo's the same. And
yeah. Occasionally there's something about your performance that you did on a demo or a weird sound that you got that you just were not able to get again. And hey, if it works in the real production, do it.
Put it in there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's no foul in that. No harm in that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, rough mixes, you'll definitely want to do them, I think, before you get to mixing stages, the real mixing stage. So then you can definitely like listen to them and be like, yes, everything is here that I want in this song. The performances are all good enough.
Mm-hmm.
We're ready to mix, you know, because you don't want to get to mixing and then be like, oh man, I wish I had played that better.
Yeah.
Or, oh man, I wish there was a string section here, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You're here right now. Yeah. Do it now, you know?
Yeah.
Or before you mix.
Yeah. So if you don't get any roughs throughout the process, at least get them like once you think you're done with the whole tracking process, tracking and overdubbing and editing and all that. And that gives you a sense of like, yes, I'm ready to move to the next stage of mixing, which we will cover in the next episode.
Cool.
Wow. This was a short one.
Wow. Quick. Oh, we've been through it.
That's all I had to say. If you got any other ideas or thoughts about tracking?
No. I mean, I think we covered it and we covered a lot of the things before, which was pre-production, how to track and
all the preparations of yourself, of your instruments. And yeah, if you do all that stuff, the tracking session should go very smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
You know what you're there to do. You know, everyone's ready for it.
Mm-hmm. You know everybody's part, what they're all doing. You know what the engineer's doing.
The engineer.
You know to give him some space.
Yeah. The engineer is prepared. They know what they're doing for the day. They have an idea of what kind of sounds you want. Everyone knows their parts. Everyone's practiced.
Tempo.
The tempo has been decided on.
Key of the song.
Key of the song is correct for your singer. When everything is lined up, it can go very smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this podcast is kind of about.
Yeah.
Is like helping you get to that point where you are making the most of your time in the studio, because it is expensive, you know, and you want to fly through it if you can.
Yeah.
And make it feel like a breeze. And everyone's having a great time, and it's fun.
Yeah.
As it should be.
I think there's been a few projects I've done here at your studio where we had 3 days to do a full record, which I think was maybe 10 or 12 songs.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, they were prepared. They came in. We did 3 takes or 4 takes of each song, whipped them out. Mm-hmm. Last day did overdubs, made some rough mixes. We got it all done within the 3 days. But that's because everybody worked really hard.
Yeah.
And was ready for the studio.
Totally.
I'm sure you've done very similar.
Yeah. I've had the opposite experience too, where people come in and they're not prepared. And
yeah,
they were hoping to get all this stuff done, and they're like, can't even get through one song. And it's like, okay, guys, you have some homework to do.
Yeah. Do you have time next week, Roy?
Yeah. So that's, you don't want to fall into that. You want to be on the other side where you come in and it's like smooth sailing.
Yeah.
And then you get great results. I don't know. I guess that's it for this episode. Please like, subscribe, send us an email, send us some comments. The ebook that this whole thing is based on is available for you at preppingforthestudio.com. So yeah, we shall see you next time.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye. Take care.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks so much for listening to Prepping for the Studio. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to your podcast from. And don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends. Episode info and my ebook, A Musician's Guide to the Recording Studio, are available at preppingforthestudio.com. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out there. Prepping for the Studio was recorded and edited at Rarefied Recording by me, Roy Silverstein. Theme music written by myself and Ariel Levine. Performed and recorded by Ariel Levine. Many thanks to my co-host, Brian Schubel, and you. Best of luck to you and your musical endeavors. And remember, as Alexander Graham Bell once said, before anything else, preparation is the key to success. We'll see you next time.